The next case for consideration is United States v. Warren. It is docket 20-1436. And after this case, we'll take a 10-minute break before the next two. We are ready to hear your argument, Mr. Lee, when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Josh Lee for the appellant, Johnny Warren. In this First Step Act case, the district court committed three separate errors in denying Mr. Warren's motion for reconsideration. The one I'd like to start with
Could we start with whether we have jurisdiction over this? We've got case law that's problematic.
So I would say first, the relevant statutes, both the First Step Act and 3582C, do permit motions for reconsideration. But even if there is
neither one of them says anything about motions for reconsideration, do they?
That's right. And the silence preserves existing law. So it's just a inherent authority of the court that when the court has the power to decide an issue, that carries with it the power to reconsider. This court.
Well, we have case law that says when you're looking at 3582C that we have three instances where we have jurisdiction to consider revising or amending a sentence. And one is compassionate release. One is it's specifically permitted by statute. And the other is the sentencing range has been lowered. Motion for reconsideration isn't considered. It isn't named in those three. And if you look at some of our case law, it would suggest that that divests us of subject matter jurisdiction over this issue.
So what this court's cases say is that, yes, you have to fall within one of these categories in which sentence modification is permitted. But Mr. Warren does fall within one of those categories because Congress has said this is the sort of sentence and the sort of offender for which you're allowed to reduce the sentence. There's nothing in this court's case law or in the statute that says each individual procedure by which a court goes about administering a substantively available sentence reduction remedy has to be expressly permitted. So, for example, the statute doesn't expressly say that courts can consider a government's response to a motion. It doesn't expressly say that the court can consider a reply or hold an evidentiary hearing or hear an appeal. Those are procedures by which courts go about administering a substantively available sentence reduction remedy. And a motion for reconsideration is no different from that. The other thing I would want to say is that if motions for reconsideration were barred, and I don't think they are, that bar would not be jurisdictional. And I think there's three cases that show that. Green, May, and the one that the government discovered, my colleague was sharp enough to find this one, although I wasn't, which is the Third Circuit's decision in Hart, which is cited on page.
And I think you are absolutely right that there's a lot of compelling authority to suggest that we're dealing with a claims processing rule and not a jurisdictional issue. But the problem that we have is we have published authority that says otherwise.
So I don't think that it says otherwise with regard to this specific issue. There's an 11th Circuit case that I cite in my brief. And the 11th Circuit case says just because 3582C in general is jurisdictional, that does not make each individual procedural restriction from that statute jurisdictional. So, for example, in the 11th Circuit case, they talked about the exhaustion requirement for compassionate release motions. And the 11th Circuit, just like this court, has said that 3582C in general is jurisdictional. But they said that doesn't mean that this specific exhaustion requirement in the compassionate release statute is jurisdictional. And the same thing is true here, that if 3582C is generally jurisdictional, that doesn't mean the specific case of a bar on motions for reconsideration, which I don't think exists, doesn't mean that that's jurisdictional.
All right. I don't want to waste any more of your time on it. I do think it's a interesting issue. So,
yes. I think the problem is not jurisdiction. The problem is what the district court did with that jurisdiction. And the error I'd like to start with this morning is the district court's failure to consider the COVID-19 pandemic in its analysis. The district court refused to consider Mr. Warren's COVID-based arguments based on the notion that he could have raised them in his 2019 motion. But as everyone agrees, the COVID-19 pandemic did not even exist at the time. So he could not have raised it in his initial motion. And in fact, the proceedings on the initial motion were over before the COVID-19 virus had even been discovered yet. So the government admits that this was erroneous, but says that the error wouldn't have made a difference to the outcome. I submit that the government has not met its burden to prove that the error was harmless and that this court should vacate the judgment because it's better to know on remand than to guess on appeal, as this court has said.
Is there a reason that it had to be brought, that you had to bring it as part of the motion for reconsideration rather than just bringing a separate motion?
While there is not a bar on motions for reconsideration, in my view, there is a bar in Section 404C of the First Step Act on second motion. So second motions are subject to a claims processing bar. Motions for reconsideration are not, which is why this was brought in a motion for reconsideration.
But even on something new, like a pandemic that hadn't existed the first time around on a separate basis entirely than, say, crack cocaine disparity?
So, first of all, new evidence and new facts is a totally ordinary basis for moving for reconsideration. That's recognized in the civil rules. It's recognized in this court's servants case. Now, in terms of a First Step Act being crack cocaine, Congress has recognized that Mr. Warren is eligible for a sentence reduction. And so the question then becomes whether the court should exercise its discretion to grant the sentence reduction. And it takes into account a totality of the circumstances in that analysis. And so COVID-19, to the extent that it bears on the 3553A factors, and it does, is a material consideration to whether the court grants a sentence reduction under the First Step Act.
And if I'm understanding correctly, you're suggesting that just the fact of COVID-19 in general should have been considered because he didn't have any specific risk factors or anything going here, did he?
That's right. The fact of the COVID-19 pandemic should be considered, and there's several reasons for that. A congregate living environment puts Mr. Warren at greater risk of contracting the illness, which posed a serious threat to his health. And he's done 18 months now of hard time, of time that's considerably more stressful and restrictive than the sentencing court contemplated at the time of the sentence. Now, we're not saying that the court would have to grant a sentence reduction based on those considerations. We're saying that the court may have granted a sentence reduction based on those considerations. In other words, it would be permissible for the court to take those into account. And courts have taken that into account in cases that I've cited in my brief. So the error is saying, I can't consider this because it could have been raised earlier. Then the question becomes, was it harmless?
Okay, before we go there, one of the issues is what else can the court consider? And the court ruled that your career offender argument way too late to make it. that you didn't make it in your original motion. And in fact, all along, the defendant has admitted that he's a career offender. And now in a motion to reconsider, you're trying to raise this new argument, which isn't what a motion to reconsider is for. And you're trying to tell me that the parties can dictate to the court the legal standard for granting a motion to reconsider. And I have big problems with that. So you're going to have to explain to me why somehow the United States could tell the district court what the standard is for granting a motion to reconsider any more than it could tell us what the standard is for granting a petition for rehearing en banc.
Okay. The first thing I want to say is that this does not impact the COVID-19 argument that I just raised.
I understand.
So I think we would prevail regardless of that on the COVID-19 argument. On the career offender issue, the rules about motions for reconsideration are judicially created, finality protecting rules, and those sorts of rules are waivable. So these are court-created rules designed to protect the United States. And if the United States...
They're waivable by us. They're not waivable by the parties. I mean, that would be the same thing as saying we've got rules, internal rules, on when we grant a petition for rehearing en banc. And you guys could get together and you could change the rules and say, we agree that it doesn't have to be an issue that's unique or unsettled or whatever, and that you will hear it en banc. And I am not buying that at all. This is not a procedural timeliness issue. This is what are the rules for when it is proper to grant a motion to reconsider.
I think that what it's analogous to is the plain error rule. So this court has developed standards and says we will only grant relief for an issue that was not raised below where these four considerations are met. But this court has clearly said that that's waivable. And the same thing is true here. So if the United States says we waive plain error review, the court reviews de novo. I would also say that I don't think that the issue of whether the reconsideration standards are waivable is necessary to decide the career offender issue. Because what the district court said is, I point to your motion for reconsideration and you are conceding the issue. And that was erroneous. Perhaps the court could decide I'm not going to consider this on reconsideration. But what the court said is not that. The court said you conceded this in your reconsideration motion. And that is separately an error of fact. And unless the court has further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Well,
hello again, Paul Farley for the government. Starting with the jurisdictional question that Judge McHugh was concerned with, we recognize that there is 10th Circuit precedent controlling it regarding 3582 is jurisdictional. As you see from our supplemental briefs, we think that's probably erroneous, but there's nothing we can do about that here. Taking the landscape as we think it is, the defendant can only prevail here if he convinces this court that the parties intended to waive the governing law applicable to motions to reconsider, that governing law can be waived, and that the court below was required to accept such a waiver. And underlying all this, of course, is the question of why it would be reversible error for a judge to apply the law applicable to motions for reconsideration to a document captioned motion for reconsideration. The government's waiver of procedural and timeliness bars waive just that, any procedural and timeliness bars. First and foremost, of course, the government waived the fact that the motion was almost 7 months too late. And as we're taking our position in the supplemental briefs, we were waiving any mandatory claim processing rules. But neither party said a word about purporting to waive the substantive law applicable to motions for reconsideration. You know, and being very practical about it, district judges review many, many motions for reconsideration, both civil and criminal. And if the parties think that this one should be treated differently, they need to say so. A sentence saying de novo review or notwithstanding servants of Pericles would at least flag for the court what was going on, but that didn't happen here. So quite naturally, Judge Arguello disregarded the motion's untimeliness and other procedural bars and treated the motion as she would any other motion for reconsideration. And as we point out in our brief, the Nelson versus Albuquerque case from this court held that failure to apply servants of Pericles to a reconsideration motion is an abuse of discretion. So the judge quite sensibly applied the law that was applicable to the document in front of her.
Let me interrupt for just one second. I mean, the government did agree to a rather broad, open-ended waiver of any procedural or timeliness bars. I mean, that is a very broad waiver, isn't
that's right.
it? And so the argument is
it's broad.
The argument is that your failure to have raised it previously is a procedural argument, not a substantive one.
And again, I don't think that a fair reading of what the parties both wrote indicate that anybody said, and this is the law that we think you need to apply. And I don't think the judge erred in taking a motion to consider reconsideration where no one specifically said, oh, by the way, treat this de novo, and treating it as she did. But I will go further, Your Honor. Even if the parties had wanted to agree that the substantive law governing motion for reconsideration wouldn't apply here, they can't bind the court. This court explained this in the Gardner versus Galetkin case in our brief. It is one thing to allow parties to forfeit claims, defenses, or lines of argument. It'd be quite another to allow parties to stipulate or bind us to application of incorrect legal standard. Here we are. The line here is between determining how to review an issue, which belongs to the court alone, and whether to review an issue, a matter over which litigants have some broad authority. Quite simply, as the Supreme Court
Let me interrupt again. I mean, your opponent cites Wood versus Milliard from the Supreme Court and says there the court said that this court could not resurrect a statute of limitations claim that had been waived by one of the parties.
Right. Statute of limitations is a defense. It's a defense. The claims and defenses and arguments can be waived by the parties because they're sort of masters of their case. What they can't do is tell the court how it's going to apply its own law. You know, even the plain error example my worthy opponent raised, that is the court's rule. The parties cannot stipulate that we're going to have a different plain error rule. And let's make this easier. How about clear error? If there's a situation where facts are to be reviewed by clear error on appeal, can the parties stipulate to de novo review? I don't think so. I mean, this goes to the heart of the judicial function. It's as old as Marbury, right? It's emphatically the province and the duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. Issue preclusion, claim preclusion, res judicata, timeliness or other kind of procedural defenses. Yeah, the parties can waive that. But when it comes to what law governs the disposition of the matter in front of us, that belongs to the judiciary. That's why the parties argue the law to you, but we can't agree to it. We can't divest the court of its authority to determine the applicable law.
Did the ruling on the career offender designation, was that based on an error of the district judge in understanding what the defendant was arguing?
Not at all. And I can parse the chronology if you would like me to, but in sum, the district court was correct that as a matter of historical fact, the defendant had given up a challenge to his career offender status, both at his original sentencing in 2008 and in his original motion for relief. I mean, in fact, in the original motion for relief, the defendant argued that they were a career offender, but at a reduced range. And it was a career offender sentence for which he argued and which he received. And so the court is exactly correct that at those two earlier steps in the case, the defendant said, yes, I am indeed a career offender. And that was what the court was saying. The court wasn't saying that, oh, on reconsideration, you've conceded it. No. But when you stand before the judge in the original motion and say, I want a career offender sentence based upon an offense level of 34, that sounds like an invited error to me, Your Honor. I've asked you to give me this sentence. And by the way, that's the one you got. But the court also said, and this is at volume one, page 390, even assuming for the sake of argument that the defendant is correct, the court need not ignore the facts of his prior crimes when deciding this motion. And then the court went through his history and, you know, the good plea deals he got and sort of ended up. And again, this is at 391. The court found that even without the career offender classification, the sentencing court believed the defendant's sentence was appropriate at the time of his issue. And this court believes that the sentence remains appropriate today. So
was the court required to calculate the applicable guideline range today before reaching a conclusion about whether or not it was appropriate, the sentence?
Not under these circumstances, Your Honor. If the court had said, I want to give him a guideline sentence, they would have had to recalculate the guidelines. But what Brown tells us, and this has been reaffirmed by the Crooks decision more recently, the First Step Act allows a court to at least consider subsequent decisional law that clarifies, not amends, the related career offender provision at issue. All right, it allows. It's not required to. And here what we see is an alternative, after a fashion, alternative holding by the court. He said, first of all, I think you gave this up in 2008 and 2019, but independent of that, looking at your criminal history and everything else, I see no basis for changing the sentence based upon your history and your conduct.
Well, didn't Crooks say that a resentencing under the First Step Act necessarily requires a correct calculation of the guidelines range?
Well, Your Honor, my reading of Crooks is that the district court there thought it wasn't allowed to revisit the career offender designation. Crooks says this twice at 997 F3rd at 1278 and 1279. He said the district court misunderstood the scope of its authority by concluding Crooks's career offender status was unreviewable. That's the error. It isn't committed under Brown to the discretion of the court under the circumstances. Now, could we find a case where it was an abuse of discretion? I think that's certainly possible, but not in a case like this where the court has said, listen, the sentence you got is the sentence you should have got because of all the things that are already in the record and which, and been detailed at some length. And so essentially, you know, the court said, even if I assume you're right about the career offender sentence, the court says, assuming for sake of argument, defendant is correct. And then the court goes on and says, I give you this sentence anyway. So I think it's harmless.
Well, but in United States versus Broadway, which is a very recent case,
yes,
from the circuit, we say that the defendant, that it requires the sentencing court to start from the correct hypothetical guidelines range when you're looking at whether they're entitled to a reduction. and that you're looking at that guideline range based on the law as it is now.
I understand. And I think if taking that language to its, you know, unvarnished as it is squarely at odds with Brown and Crooks. And I think Brown and Crooks both say it's permissible, not required. We're going to look at the particular circumstances at play.
Well, in Brown said the First Step Act allows a district court to at least consider. But then in Crooks, we said yes, it necessarily requires the correct calculation of the guideline range. And then in Broadway, which I think is the most recent one, we said it requires a sentencing court to start from the correct hypothetical guidelines range. If I'm reading those cases correctly, which obviously we'll take another look at, the court didn't do that here, did it?
The court did not do that, but I would say two things, Your Honor. First of all, if we have some sort of, let's say, discrepancy between Crooks and Brown and Broadway, I'd have to look and see whether Brown or Broadway were earlier. I guess we would defer to the earlier precedent.
It's the earlier precedent, but Brown doesn't, there is no conflict. Brown says you have to at least do this. So it doesn't, I don't see any conflict between these cases.
I would quote Brown at 974, 1139 to 40, that the act allows.
Will you give me the site again? I'm sorry. 974 what?
974 F3rd, 1139 to 40, allows a district court at least consider the subsequent decisional law. Da, da, da. Crooks says, quotes Brown and at that precise same language, allows a district court to at least consider a defendant's claim that sentencing him as a career offender would be error. Okay. Now
that's Crooks quoting Brown. But then later, Crook says that at 1278, that it necessarily requires a correct calculation. So obviously we need to take a hard look at our own precedent and find out where we are. But what we can agree on is if it was required, it wasn't done.
That's after we get through all the jurisdictional and claim processing and the ability to waive the standard of review, right? I mean, you have to jump through several hurdles to get there.
Right.
I have 50 seconds. Just the passage out of Crooks that I would, if you're going to look at it, at 1278, the court said, the district court reached this conclusion because it determined Crooks' designation as a career offender was unreviewable. Okay, so that's context in which I'm reading Crooks, is that there was a district court error said, I cannot revisit the career offender thing. And I think that clearly was an error. And so hopefully you will give us some clarification.
But you're saying that it would be okay for the district court to say, I choose not to.
If the district court chooses to deny the reduction based upon other considerations such as a criminal history and dangerousness, if we want to use that word, protecting the public, they need not do that.
So do you think that the court at a minimum has to say, assuming, as the court did here, assuming that these predicates no longer would qualify for career offender, I still would have the same sentence? Or do you think the court could say, I get all of this career offender stuff every day and I'm not buying any of it, so you're out of luck?
I don't think a court could. I think it would be abuse of discretion that and say it in each and every one of these cases, I will never refuse. I never will look at the career offender status, because I think that flies pretty close to being in the face of Crooks. But so I think the fact that the court said, even assuming for the sake of argument that I give you that, it doesn't change anything. I think in this case, that pretty much settles it. I see I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to reemphasize that whether the reconsideration standard is waivable has no impact on Mr. Warren's COVID-19 argument. The district court erred by not considering the COVID-19 considerations raised by Mr. Warren, and that error was not harmless. The reason that error wasn't harmless is because Mr. Warren had a substantial case for a sentence reduction. So the COVID-19 concerns that he raised may have tipped the balance. The other thing I want to say about the waiver issue, so moving away from the COVID-19 argument, is that when the government is saying you deny reconsideration based on the restrictions on reconsideration, what it's saying is you should have raised this career offender argument before judgment. It's too late. You should have raised it in your original motion. But that's the same thing as procedural default, which is waivable. It's the same thing as statute of limitations, which is waivable. It's the same thing as res judicata. All of these are, you should have raised this argument earlier so it can't be considered. And this reconsideration restriction on raising new arguments that could have been raised earlier, it's just a finality protecting procedural defense, like all of the other procedural defenses that the court has said are waivable. The other reason you know it's waivable is because the reconsideration restrictions, like the ones I mentioned, are not jurisdictional. They're court-created rules and therefore not jurisdictional, and non-jurisdictional rules are waivable. Thank you, Your Honors. And for the reasons I've said, I'd ask that the court vacate and remand for the court to revisit Mr. Warren's motion.
Thank you both for your arguments. The case is submitted.